a lot of slides, a lot of promises, but that's not a plan.
The Bristol Bay community responds to the Pebble Mine proposal. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Ketchikan drug bust uncovers large quantities of heroin and methamphetamine.
So you're looking at probably well over $200,000 worth of methamphetamine alone.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
The United Tribes of Bristol Bay has called Pebble's new conceptual plan a wolf in sheep's clothing, another attempt at bribery, and the latest in a long list of lies. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more on how another longtime opponent sees this week's news as more of an investment ploy than a serious attempt to put a mine into permitting.
Rick Alford is a Republican former state Senate president and these days spends a lot of his time working to protect the PFD, but he also has been one of Pebble's staunchest opponents and has worked closely with Trout Unlimited, United Tribes of Bristol Bay, and others to block this mine and others from being developed in the Bristol Bay watershed. He looked through the new information from Pebble on Thursday.
My first question is, how are they going to, before the end of this year, actually apply for a permit? That's the core promise of what was announced. And there's a lot of slides, a lot of promises, but that's not a plan.
Halford says what's being presented now is certainly more interesting than some of the back of the pizza box plans from the past, but he's still skeptical the company is even serious about taking the project through. He thinks this conceptual rollout is aimed at investors, not regulators and not the public.
I mean, that's their real experience is more mining in the stock market than mining in the ground. I mean, the big mining interests have walked away from the project at the expense of hundreds of millions of dollars. So they're looking for another large mining interest, and anything they can do to make the project look viable is to their advantage.
He's also suspicious about whether the public is seeing the same presentation that investors are, especially after Northern Dynasty Minerals CEO Ron Deason was quoted in Denver recently, talking about a project that will last for many generations, not just the 20-year project Pebble says it will take into permitting.
It's very difficult to see how you could ever enforce a small mine limitation. I mean, you have a combination of multinational interests that it would take to develop it. And it's not going to be, we're going to do this partly. Once you start, you have opened and empowered a mining district with infrastructure. And it's going to go as far as they can find resources.
Pebble says that any increase in the size or scope of mining activities on the deposit is certainly possible when the first effort wraps up, but all new efforts will require separate and extensive permitting. But there's no illusion by anybody that there's a lot of copper and gold northwest of Iliamna, and several companies, Pebble included, are interested in someday going after it. Looking through Pebble's new basic concept, Halford says he is interested to see more details about a few of the ideas, and he's still very skeptical about some of the other claims.
One of those being that you can somehow separate the impact on the Nooshiak drainage and the Kwajak drainage, when in fact the deposit sits in a saddle that really is straddles both of them, and it's pretty hard to separate when you have subsurface exchange between drainages.
Halford says the ball is now in Pebble's court to put an actual plan together and file a permit application, something he doesn't think may ever happen, let alone by December. He says the opposition to Pebble is growing and clear in its mission. Halford was heartened to see Governor Bill Walker come out opposed to Pebble earlier this week. He suspects more announcements like that will be coming rather than the other way around. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Three people were arrested in a drug bust in Ketchikan Tuesday night. During the bust, Ketchikan police seized a pound of methamphetamine, 2¾ ounces of heroin, a handgun, and a semi-automatic assault rifle loaded with armor-piercing bullets. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Charged in the bust were 31-year-old Arthur Castillo, 52-year-old Loretta Garcia, and 31-year-old Alfonso Sandoval. Also during the raid, police seized about $16,500 cash, paraphernalia they say is related to drug sales, and some pot. The bust was a result of a months-long investigation. During a news conference at the police station just hours after the raid, the drugs, cash, and weapons were laid out on display in the briefing room. Sergeant Mike Purcell estimated the street value of the drugs, starting with the methamphetamine.
0.2 grams will sell for about $100. This is a little over a pound, so you're looking at probably well over $200,000 worth of methamphetamine alone. The heroin, if you break it all the way down to a street level, 0.1 gram typically goes for $100. So total value of that, I think, was over $70,000.
Sergeant Andy Burnson says the three suspects were contacted downtown on Main Street. Police knew ahead of time about the firearms and made sure to make the arrest away from where those weapons were kept. Burnson says the cash and firearms were found at Garcia's home on North Tongass Highway.
The AR-15, the assault rifle, and which was loaded, was propped up inside, leaning against the side of her closet. Right up above it was a large stack of over $5,000 of the cash, literally sitting on top of that .44 Magnum revolver you can see right there. Right in the middle, like behind the divider of the closet, was a locked safe that contained the bulk of the rest of the cash.
Burnson says the drugs and more cash were seized from Castillo's apartment. He says this is the largest drug bust at a residence in Ketchikan that he can remember and is the first time they've seized an assault rifle with armor-piercing bullets. The guns are not illegal to own, but if guns are used in connection with a crime, they can be forfeited. So far, the defendants have not been charged with weapons misconduct. Burnson says more charges are possible as the investigation continues. He says the defendants were charged initially with crimes police felt confident they had immediate evidence to support. Garcia, Castillo, and Sandoval were each charged with 2 counts of second-degree misconduct involving a controlled substance. Castillo faces an additional charge of third-degree misconduct involving a controlled substance. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
A new fighter jet will be at Eielson Air Force Base for testing this month. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports the F-35A Lightning II will be the first of its kind to visit Eielson. It's a multi-purpose fighter plane designed to replace older fighters, including the Air Force's F-16 Fighting Falcons and the Navy's aircraft carrier-based F-18 Hornet, among others. The F-35 is the most expensive weapons program in U.S. history. Each one costs about $95 million. The U.S. plans to buy more than 2,400 of them and sell hundreds to allies. Construction at Eielson began during the summer to prepare for 2 squadrons coming in 2020. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitkins pay tribute to a legendary Tlingit athlete.
He had the ability in all sports, things that coaches try to teach, to her became natural.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil Energy lives here.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Testing for perfluorinated compounds that have tainted wells in South Fairbanks and Moose Creek is expanding across the state. Utqiagvik is the latest community to detect the synthetic chemicals, which were found last month in a lake sometimes used for drinking water. Perfluorinated compounds formerly used widely in firefighting foam and as coatings on a range of consumer products, are considered a human health risk, and the Environmental Protection Agency issued a national advisory last year. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Water Quality Program Manager Cindy Christian says the compounds, which have not been conclusively linked to human health problems, are not regulated in drinking water, but the DEC encourages water source testing.
And most public water systems, I have to say, have been very responsive to that, that when we've said that you might want to do this, that they've all gone out and done that. This is really, really at the infancy, and so we don't have a whole lot of results back. I think we probably will see more water supplies affected.
Christian emphasizes carbon water filtration systems already in place at many utilities remove perfluorinated compounds, but many private wells are vulnerable.
Most private wells are not treated, or, you know, a lot of people in the interior, especially, well, and throughout the state, because we have a lot of iron and things like that in the water. So people will have softeners or maybe filters, but they might not have the type of carbon filter that would remove PFAS and PFOA.
EPA regulation of manufacturing use of perfluorinated compounds began in 2000, but the substances commonly persist in water worldwide, and State Environmental Health Program Manager Sandrine Deglan says they are evident in most people's blood.
They are found in about 98%, 99% of the U.S. population.
Deglan stresses levels have been dropping since perfluorinated compounds came under regulation. She says research is ongoing, and until there's more conclusive data on health effects, people are advised not to drink water found to contain the compounds. An Army Corps of Engineers contractor completed cleanup work last week at an old pump station near Quartz Lake that was part of a pipeline that the military used decades ago to transport gasoline, diesel, and aviation fuel from Haines to bases in the interior. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Anchorage-based Bristol Environmental Remediation Services removed 15,000 tons of fuel-contaminated soil from the old timber pump station near Quartz Lake. But Army Corps of Engineers project manager Beth Astley says the contractor couldn't remove contamination that had reached groundwater and spread.
So there's a fairly large plume of contamination in the groundwater there.
Astley says the Corps of Engineers will monitor groundwater around the timber station to determine whether the contamination is still spreading and whether removing the tainted soil above is reducing the level of contaminants in the groundwater below.
We're going to be installing several groundwater monitoring wells, and we'll be taking groundwater samples to determine what the residual contaminant concentrations are now that we've done the soil removal.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation says fuel spills can unleash many chemical compounds that pose a threat to human health, especially benzene, a cancer-causing substance. Astley says the timber station cleanup project cost $3.5 million, and she says Bristol Environmental began another cleanup this week at the site of an old tank farm near Birch Lake that also was part of the Haines-Fairbanks pipeline.
The contract allows 1,500 tons of petroleum-impacted soil to be removed.
Astley says the Birch Lake project's expected to be completed by the end of the month. She says that'll be the fourth cleanup the Corps of Engineers has conducted this summer on facilities that were part of the old pipeline, which ran from Haines to Fairbanks through a portion of Canada, then along the Alaska Highway and Richardson Highway. It operated from 1954 to 1973. Astley says plans call for work to continue at three other pipeline facilities near Sears Creek, Toke, and the main terminal at Haines. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Sitkins paid their final respects this week to Herb Diedrichsen. The 91-year-old Tlingit elder died in Sitka on September 25th. In many ways, Diedrichsen was everything you'd expect a man of his generation. But Diedrichsen was also something most can never claim to be: the greatest athlete ever produced in Alaska. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has more.
The stories have always sounded like myth. I saw Herb Diedrichsen often as an older man in the stands cheering on the Mount Edgecombe Braves. Invariably, someone would point to him and tell me that Diedrichsen had been a huge star in his day, and then at 5'10", he could dunk a basketball from a standing jump and maybe bump his elbows on the rim. Yet, people who saw and played against Diedrichsen in his prime don't dispute any of the stories. Gil Truitt was just a couple of years behind Diedrichsen in school.
He had the ability in all sports. Things that coaches try to teach to Herb, it came natural. He didn't have to work hard, but I never knew of anyone who worked harder in any sport than Herb. He was continually and constantly trying to improve himself as an athlete.
Dietrichson honed his skills as a student athlete against the big military teams stationed in Sitka during World War II. He averaged around 30 points a game in his student days. Later, playing gold medal basketball for Sitka's A and B team, Dietrichson's average dropped as he developed his mastery of the assist and a style of basketball that would later become associated with NBA greats like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson.
There's not a team in America, not a team in America that he wouldn't have started for as a guard.
John Abel is also something of a basketball legend. Growing up in Sitka, he watched Dietrichson play gold medal. Abel graduated from Sitka High in 1954 and went on to play for Oregon State University and eventually coach for the 1964 Olympics.
I've seen worldwide athletes, worldwide basketball players, and it can be etched in stone that I never saw a basketball team at any level that Herb Dietrichson couldn't have played for. As a point guard, Herb Dietrichson was 40 years ahead of his time.
I interviewed Abel and Truett in 2012 when they had nominated Dietrichson for the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. Dietrichson was already in the Gold Medal Hall as well as the Alaska High School Hall, but he was never really tested outside of the state. It was important to frame Dietrichson's nomination against other inductees like Carlos Boozer and Libby Riddles.
I look around and I see players now at the college level, and there's no doubt in my mind that he would have been able to play with any of them in today's game. And that's a big statement. I understand that.
What do you mean he was 40 years ahead of his time?
I watched him, and as I'd see point guards and I'd see year after year, I would see things develop, and I'm thinking, my gosh, I saw Herb do that back in the 50s.
Gil Truett says that Dietrichson and his teammate Moses Johnson perfected what they were calling the lob pass, but is nowadays referred to as the alley-oop. Basically, a player sprints for the basket and jumps just as his teammate has lobbed up the ball. Done right, it results in a dunk or an elegant tip-in. Although Dietrichson was only 5'10", Truett says he could do either.
Standing under the basket, he was able to jump and dunk the ball from a standing position under the basket. And he did mention that he bumped his elbow on the rim a few times.
Aha, the bumping elbow story rides again. Just one more reason, according to the Hall of Fame, that it considers Dietrichson to be the Jim Thorpe of Alaska. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com.
Would you like to play an integral part to what you're listening to? Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, we thank you. If you'd like to become a member or sponsor, it's really easy. Start with a call to this station or visit us at our website.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Eric Bork. This week on AK, an Alaska Native dance festival in the community of Wales. Now in its 18th year, the Wales Kinigmute Dance Festival was revived after years of absence. KNOM's Gabe Colombo has more.
It's 2 a.m. at the western tip of the Seward Peninsula. The northern lights dance outside in the starry autumn sky above the community of Wales. And inside the school gymnasium, the Shishmaref Kigigtuk dancers show no signs of letting up either. The Wales Kinigmute Dance Festival is now in its 18th year. It was started in the 1990s, when the native dance tradition in Wales was revived after decades of absence. It's since grown to be one of the largest Alaska Native dance festivals in the state. It's a high-energy, late-night celebration of family, community, and cultural heritage.
Okay, just put them in that room.
Anna Uksarak is president of the Native Village of Wales, which organizes the festival. Throughout the weekend, she's running around town and the school, making sure everything goes smoothly. When she has a few moments to talk, she explains the festival is about more than dance.
To me, it's a healing process. If you look, they're visiting, they don't get to see each other, but maybe once a year, you know, a lot of relatives that never see each other are getting to see each other. We're meeting our relatives that we didn't know.
Across the room, a group of women are singing songs in Inupiaq. One of the singing women is Sophie Nothstein, a member of the Anchorage Kinnickmute Singers and Dancers. Nothstein says it was difficult to see her culture suppressed by white missionaries in the 20th century. Dancing, she says, helps overcome some of those negative feelings. She asks not to be recorded, but says, quote, "Coming here makes us feel whole," end quote. Edward Tiulana, with the King Island Dancers, says he can feel that when he's performing.
We have to work together as a partnership. You can't try to sing over someone, you know. And when you hit that note where everything is in harmony, you know, it's like, it's hard to explain.
But he tries to put his feelings into words.
Keeping the drum beat, the heartbeat. I look into my skin on the drum, especially when we really get going, because that vibration, you can see it. And it's alive, you know, it's a real thing. When you're able to, you know, reach that level, it's like mystical. It's like the songs are alive and they take over your body.
Many of the songs he sings originated in a place that's been uninhabited for about half a century. King Island lies due south of Wales and northwest of Nome. Tiulana describes it to me.
It's like a fortress sticking out of the water. There's no beach, it's all huge boulders, and it's like a mile long and a mile and a half wide.
Tiulana used to live on the island. His grandfather, who started the dance group there, began teaching him how to drum when he was 5. Today, he lives in Anchorage and works as a dance instructor at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Tiulana says it takes dedication and passion to preserve the tradition.
I sit there and I listen to recordings all day long. Hundreds and hundreds of times. Get the song right, to sing it right. Some of these old recordings from the 20s, to listen to those guys, they're on point every single time. No mistakes. Their voices are all matching. They're like on the other level.
The King Island Dancers is one of the largest groups at the festival, with nearly 15 drummers who fill the gymnasium with thunderous sound. Dancers don traditional head and arm pieces and animal masks. The group even brings out oars and performs a rowing dance. Beneath the dances, there's an undercurrent of mourning for lost homeland like King Island and lost community members. The festival is dedicated to 3 elders and 3 youth who died in the past year. 1 elder originally from King Island, the other 5 all from Wales. A young boy from King Island, no older than 4 or 5, dons arm pieces and dances with the men. The Wales Kinnickmute Dancers are a young group. Maybe half of them are under 25. Among the many who tell me how crucial the mix of ages is Anouk Pollock, also known as Denise. It's her first time at the festival, where she's dancing with the Anchorage Kinnickmute. She's originally from Shishmaref, and many of her family there dance and sing. But she grew up between Ukiavik, Fairbanks, and Massachusetts. After time in Washington, D.C., Pollock moved back to Alaska to work with her native town on facing the effects of climate change.
After everything I've experienced and all the places I've lived or traveled, this is where I feel the most connected. What's most meaningful to me is being connected to my Inupiaq community and speaking the Inupiaq language and working to protect our lands and our lifeways.
She says that includes preserving the dance tradition, which for her has become a source of inspiration.
I always feel refreshed after going to dance class, and it's such a great way to begin the week. It feels like I get a lot of energy to go forward with the work that I do.
As the golden full moon sets just off the Cape Prince of Wales and plunges into the sea, the dance goes on. I'm Gabe Colombo.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Andrew Jasper in Bethel. Jasper is originally from Aniak and works as a behavioral health aide for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Consortium.
I think my background is mainly like social work, helping people. I like helping people. When there's accident happening in the village, when I'm called to go out, I go out and do that. I want to help my people, you know, because a lot of them are using substance abuse, maybe drugs and alcohol, and I want to help those people, you know, get better. Growing up here, you know, I learned a lot from my elders, and that's what I'm doing now, is passing down the knowledge I learned from my elders. My passion is playing music. I play a variety of instruments. I play guitar, I play mandolin, I play keyboards, I play violin, a little bit of harmonica, a little bit of bass. When my brother came home from high school, he bought in a guitar, and that's when I learned how to play the guitar. Country music, mixed country and maybe country rock, and I have a band of my own, Jasper Band from Aniak. And we do fiddle dances in villages. When we're called to go to villages, that's what we do. I'd rather have our own, you know, not too many people. Because when I went out of state, there were too many people out there. I'd rather have, not too many people from outside. But they can come and visit if they want to, but not to stay here. I never considered to move out of state, but I'm thinking of moving out of Bethel to Anchorage, maybe.
Andrew Jasper lives in Bethel. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Gabe Colombo, Jared James, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Eric Bork.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com.
Would you like to play an integral part to what you're listening to? Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, we thank you. If you'd like to become a member or sponsor, it's really easy. Start with a call to this station or visit us at our website. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.